Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Dave M. from the Port Fishington Group down in Philly.
Oh, God, these lights. So always remember that about this meeting. My name's Dave. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 23rd of 2004. I want to just say real quick that I would be lying to you guys if I wanted to give you the impression that I had anything to do with that. If you hear nothing else about what I have to say tonight, please hear me when I say that. 10 seconds before I got sober, getting sober was not on the list of things to do that particular day. I guess you guys will hear about that in a bit. My home group meets, matter of fact, it's meeting as we speak, Monday night at 7:30 in the lovely, glorious section of Philadelphia known as Kensington. I wouldn't presume that anyone here would know anything about that. But a meeting is the same format as this. I love being there. I like being around people that are in action. We get an interesting kind of new person there. We get a lot of people to just wander in because they're stuck there and from North Carolina or Virginia or wherever they came from. But I find it useful because we're right, you know, it's like ground zero, you know. I find the format really effective. I don't know about anybody else, but I, as a new person, I thought it was very important to sound good in AA. And something else I want to tell you, that's really very not important. I've met some people in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous that have absolutely blown me away from a podium. And then I spent 10 minutes with them and I realized that they were absolute scumbags. And I've met some other people that really, you know, it's like watching paint dry. And they're probably the most genuine people I've ever met in my life. And so that's my little, sorry, I prayed that I wasn't going to go on any tangents, and I already blew that one. So, I'm not from Philly originally. I was born and raised in Ocean City, New Jersey. I had a mother and father that loved each other very much. They were together right up until the day my mom died, 27 years. I have an older brother. We were taught a lot. I don't know about anybody else, but I was like raised, you know, go to church, how to treat people. They taught me about compassion, how to, you know, be mindful of other people and be aware of your surroundings and blah, blah, blah. I don't know why, and I don't know why this is a condition that I often hear in Alcoholics Anonymous or hear other people that have this problem. But anything that's good for me, and this is true right up until probably, you know, on my way here tonight, anything that's really, really good for me is not something I'm inclined to do. It's just, I don't know, it's like in my nature. And everything that they had told me about, I don't know, I just had this thought in my head when I was a kid, like, that's kind of corny. I don't really think I want to do that. I remember as a really little kid, being like 5 years old, and this is the kind of head I had, I would think, all right, it's Sunday morning. Now I know what Sunday morning means. Mom's going to come upstairs and drag me to church like she does every Sunday. So I would think, as a five-year-old, I'm going to hide under the bed. She'll look for me. She won't see me. And they'll just go without me. Made perfectly good sense in my head. And we all know that's not what happened. She knew where I hid because I hid there every week. And she drugged me out, put these clothes on me that I didn't want to be wearing, and took me to church. At which time I played tic-tac-toe on the, you know, little mass cards or whatever they were giving out. Just found no interest in that stuff at all. From a social standpoint, my childhood was very painful. Social situations are still not my strong suit. I'm very socially awkward. I like to refer to myself as a social misfit. But as a kid, the best thing I can tell you is it was draining. just the thought of me having to go to school the next day was dread. I'd just be laying in bed thinking about it, thinking about what they were going to say, how I was going to respond. And then they're going to say this, and then I'll come back with that, and then they'll say this, I'll say that. They'll be ashamed of themselves, and I'll be the big shot. Never happened that way. I seem to run into a lot of people in my life that don't follow a script. Because I had a plan for anything you were going to say to me. But these guys would show up and they would kind of say something that I didn't have a plan for. So I would just look stupid and stutter and stammer and then walk away. Now later on, many years later when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out we have this little thing. We like to refer to it as the committee. You know that conversation you have in your head? Well, I was having that at 6 in kindergarten. And I'd walk away from these people and in my head I'd be thinking, I don't know about anybody else, but you always think about what you should have said an hour after you should have said it. And I should have said, oh, just to drive me nuts. But I burn a lot of energy as a kid thinking about that stuff. I burn a lot of energy thinking about how I was going to get you to like me. I burn a lot of energy around trying to figure out and navigate everything in this world. You will hear some amazing speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous that will convey that feeling. People refer to it as a hole in the soul, a spiritual malady, a disconnect. What I can tell you is that I can't really describe it to you, but I can tell you that something was wrong. If you were to ask me what was wrong then, I probably couldn't explain it to you. But something was not right. It always seemed like everybody else was over here, and there was a fence, and then I was on the other side of the fence trying to figure out how I was going to get over there. But I never seemed to make it over. Just always on the outside looking in, figuring like, wow, they look like they're having, you know, and then self-pity kind of builds off of that. Like, look at all the fun they're having, and I'm over here. Well, at the age of 8, all of that changed. And it changed on a dock in Linwood, New Jersey. Just a side note for anybody that vacations down the shore and you think there's so much to do down there. I live down there. There was nothing going on. It cracks me up. Everybody from Philly's like, I'm going down the shore. I'm like, yeah, okay, big fun. There's nothing happening down there. You either drink on the docks or you drink in the woods. Take your pick. That was about it. So this one particular day, we were on the docks, and it was a bunch of kids. All the neighborhood kids would all get together. And I don't know, I've always been fascinated, and I had this trait when I was a kid, and I still have it. I'm very fascinated by human nature. I like to just watch people. It's a pretty neat trait to have, although sometimes being an Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be honest with you, I wish I didn't have it. I've seen some pretty crazy stuff. But as a kid, I'm watching all these kids interact, and you know what I noticed was all these people had coolers, and would all come at the coolers, and would get the beer out, and they would take a sip, and then when nobody was looking, they would like pour it out into the bay, and then you know, I'm so wasted, man. Something happened inside of me, because I kept watching this go on that whole night, and I thought there's got to be something to what they're pretending to do. If somebody's pretending to do something, there's got to be a reason why. Kind of became intriguing for me. And I had 4 Rolling Rock Pony bottles that night. And something happened. You know, I don't want to be controversial or anything like that, but if you listen in Alcoholics Anonymous and you listen to people as they share their stories, to me, when somebody talks about what happens the first time they drank, sounds an awful lot like what happens to us after we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and take the 12 steps. Because I'll tell you what, man, I just described a small snippet of what my childhood was like. And in the blink of an eye, it was all gone. I wasn't worried about what you were thinking about me anymore. I just said what I had to say. I wasn't worried about how you were going to respond to me. I just said what I had to say. And now here's the big icing on the cake for me. Not only wasn't I worried about all that, as I was saying it, I was kind of convinced internally in my heart that you were digging what I was saying. That's what alcohol does for me. Now, I spent about 20 years of my life, give or take, coming in and out of AA. I was introduced to AA when I was 15 years old. And what I just shared with you, I personally believe was the biggest reason why I could never get sober. Because I would always come to Alcoholics Anonymous and look at alcoholism as this outside, external thing. And I would listen to people share from that standpoint. And I would say, I'm an alcoholic because I'm homeless. I'm an alcoholic because I lost my job. I'm an alcoholic because I robbed from my family. I'm an alcoholic because I cheat on anything in my life. And all those things are just what happens to me as a result of my drinking. What makes me an alcoholic is what happened to me on that dock when I was 7 years old. Now, I'm not saying I would have walked into an AA meeting the next day. But that in itself. Now, all them other times I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was already, like, my logic was screwed from the door. I was never going to get this down or figure this out, looking at it from that standpoint. And I've met people. I used to live with a kid whose worst night, he was sleeping under his parents' millionaire house's deck because they locked him out of the house by accident. That was his worst night. And when I talked to that kid, he had alcoholism on the inside worse than me. And, you know, I've had experiences like that in the time that I've been sober to help me to realize alcoholism has no kind of, like, grade. Like, if you're homeless, you're somehow more alcoholic than the housewife. It's so not true. It's so not true. And sometimes some of the housewife stories that I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous are 10 times more painful than some of the most horrendous stories I've heard. So that little experience at age 8 kind of set the stage for the rest of my childhood. And here's the way it went down. There was no experimenting for me. I left that dock. And I don't want to mislead you guys. And I can clearly remember saying that this is the thing that's going to change my life. But when I look back on that night, I knew that I found something that worked. Like, I could not hide from the reality of the reward that alcohol gave me. I realized, wow, I don't have to worry about this. I don't have to. It's just like I'm free and easy with people. And so there was no experimenting. In a very short period of time, I was drinking before school. I was drinking at school. Started getting older. And the big move is 8th grade to 9th grade because then you got to go to high school. And I remember my first day in high school and I'm getting the lay of the land. And I'm watching these kids. And they were like, you could already tell my first day, they were like respected. They were like revered by all the other kids. And I started watching them because I wanted that. One of the other little features of my alcoholism is that I have this undying need and desire to be accepted and liked by you. You know that old saying, if I meet 100 people and 99 people love me and one person hates me, I will spend all my time worried about that one person than all the other 99 people. So I'm in high school and I'm watching these guys and trying to find the right way to say. In the interest of the traditions, let's just say these guys were selling non-AA conference-approved substances. Use your imagination. It was the paper form of alcohol. If anybody has any questions about that, see me after the meeting. I'll explain it to you. So I decided I'm going to do what they're doing. I'm going to, you know, because I want what they had to offer. I wanted that same kind of respect. Probably missed a little part of that. They were really good at that life, and I'm not. There's something that goes with that lifestyle, and one of it is you got to be like kind of confrontational with people. You know, like if I give little Billy something on Friday, and next Friday he's supposed to bring me back $40, and he doesn't bring me back $40, now I'm supposed to do something. Well, I ain't doing it. I'm not that guy. It's just not my nature. So needless to say, it was not a very good business venture for me. And in a very short period of time, I was standing in front of a judge getting sentenced to juvenile life. And the reason for that is very simple. There was one reason why I was doing that, and one reason only. It was all ego-driven, because you had to know that I was that guy. I wasn't doing it because I was into that life. I was doing it because I wanted to be accepted. And I never really thought, it never even occurred to me that you guys would accept me just for who I am. That never even crossed my mind. I automatically jumped to, I got to do what they're doing because that's how they got it, so I got to get it too. So I did a lot of different things based on that, that are, like, when I look back on it, ridiculous. This was in 1989. So I don't know if anybody remembers cell phones back then. They were very large. But I used it as often as I could, in front of as many people as I could, because there was a certain status attached to it. And I thought it was cool. But the reality was, I looked like I was calling in troop reinforcements in Vietnam. I mean, the battery would go dead in like 2 hours. It was like unbelievable. Crazy. So I ended up, you know, I got arrested really quick, you know. And they got me. They planted a chick, again, using my ego. They planted this girl in the school, and I was like trying to show off for her, you know. And then that Friday, of all days, it was Good Friday. There's a knock at my door, and I go over to the door, and I look out, and it's her. And, you know, of course, I'm thinking, well, she wants me. That's why she's here. I didn't notice the cops standing behind her, and they ripped my house apart in front of my parents. And, you know, it got that look. And I don't know if anybody else in this room knows that look that you get from your family or your parents. My father was one of them, like, real stern guys, who had the ability to look over his glasses. And I got that look. And it kind of like a disappointed look. And I remember, it's just one of them looks you don't want to see a lot. And I got to see that quite often as the years went on. So I got drug off, went a little crazy before that, ran away, blah, blah, blah. Typical teenager stuff. Stood in front of this judge, got sentenced to juvenile life, and off I went. Now, I want to tell you guys something. I really, there's a lot of, like, really goofy parts of my story and really funny, and I'm a really big believer in enjoying sobriety and laughing in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I got to tell you that there is nothing funny about what I did to my family. And I'm going to share a story with you in 1 minute. Something I did to my family, absolutely 100% completely stone sober, and probably caused more damage to my family that day than I did on any day that I was getting loaded. I really, you know, a little side note, I that little announcement about having Al-Anon and Al-Anon here, I think that is like one of the coolest things I've heard in a long time, because I do believe that to be true. So I went to jail and got going with the regular things that we do going to jail, making them calls. You know them calls you make from jail when you're putting pressure on your family to come get you or bring you money or do stuff for you? Well, I started making them calls. And I got to tell you guys, like, when you're in it, you don't realize it. But until you get removed from it a little bit, or you see it from somebody else's perspective when somebody else is doing it to a member of your family, or you witness somebody else doing it, you don't realize the damage that causes to somebody. Because I would make promises I knew I was never going to keep. You know, Dad, I'm going to, you know, it's going to be different when I get out this time. I'm going to be the son that you thought you lost. Like, think about that promise that you're making to an absolutely broken man. You're making this promise that you already know you're not going to keep. But you got to kind of tug at his heartstrings a little bit, because that's how you're going to get him to do what you want. And I'll tell you something, man. Only through the 12-step process did I realize the damage that I caused to my father. If there's anybody in this room that's kind of like trying to avoid amends, I can tell you that that's where most of the freedom is in this program, I believe. And if you listen to enough speakers, you'll realize probably some of the most powerful stories that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous are based off of amends. So I started making them calls. Started getting really comfortable in jail. I don't know about anybody else. My first day there, I was scared to death. Scared to death. Like, I can't even believe I'm here. But 2 or 3 days into it, man, it was like nothing. And that's a little trait, I think, for the we will adapt to anything. You know, you hear that old saying about Marines improvise, adapt to overcome. They got nothing on us. Nothing. The things that the human condition will adapt to and make okay are just mind-boggling to me. And that's a little trend that happened throughout my life. And as time went on, the things that I had to justify to myself that were happening to me were getting worse and worse. But I still made it okay. Always. So I'm in there, kind of writing a lot of letters. I don't know if we got any letter writers in here. Writing a lot of letters to the judge, very apologetic. And one day they woke me up at like 4 in the morning and they said, "You got to get dressed, you're going to court." And I'm like, "Court? I already was sentenced." So they took me down in front of this judge, Judge Winkelstein. I'll never forget it, Harvey Winkelstein. And he said, "Son, state law says I can't let you go until your 18th birthday. But I'm going to do you one better." He said, "I'm going to release you from our custody into a treatment center." And the next day they let me go and I had to take a bus and I went over to Philadelphia. I was going to this place called The Bridge on Pine Road in Philadelphia. It's a long-term treatment center. And I had a week that I had to kill, you know, a little paperwork snafu. I know it's not, you know, out of the realm of possibilities in the treatment world. So, you know, they were like, we don't have a bed for you until next Tuesday. So I did what I do best. Because now that I, and a little important to note, I think, when I'm in jail, I do pretty good. I'm not saying I jail good because I don't think anybody jails good. But my internal condition is okay. And I realize something. The reason that I'm okay in jail is because somebody else is managing everything for me. I don't really have to worry about nothing. Everything's taken care of. You know when you're going to eat. You know where you got to go. It's not until they say those faithful words, "Malloy, pack it up." And then all of a sudden, man, something would happen. Just like a walk. I would walk 200 feet from the block to the receiving room. And something would happen in my head. I could be in jail 8 months, 9 months, 11 months, whatever my time was. And I did a lot of them. And I would have the best of intentions. I mean, like, you know, going to every meeting in there. I'm like the chairman of the self-help committee in the whole jail. I'm doing all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, "Malloy, pack it up." And I'm putting my clothes on, and I'm like, I got a whole different kind of mindset going on. And I never understood what that was. So I get into this treatment center after a week of being on the streets. And I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting during that week. I went. I didn't really go because I wanted to go. I came out of a blackout outside of an AA meeting. That's how I went to my first meeting. I don't know about anybody else. I came out, it was like a brownout, actually, because I kind of remember some stuff, but not all the stuff. And all I remember is like, "Well, there I am." And there's like a bunch of guys standing around with white cups. And I'm like, "What in the hell?" And they're like, "Come on up, meeting start." So I walk up these stairs. It was a meeting at Life or Death at Tarsdale and Blakiston Streets in Philadelphia. They had the air conditioning on about 42. I don't know if that's some kind of AA policy. But it was freezing in there. Nobody thought it necessary to inform me that there was a gun range downstairs from the meeting. And I'm already a little freaked out about Philly because I'm not some city kid. So I'm like sitting in a meeting hearing gunshots. I'm like, "What is..." But I got the first act of compassion shown to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was done by a man who's no longer with us. His name was Bud R. They called him. And so I learned early in Alcoholics Anonymous, everybody gets a nickname because they call Bud the Handyman. Bud won the lottery twice, by the way. Does that piss anybody else off? So crazy to me. I just find like, and then I just mentioned that to somebody last week, somebody who knew him, and they're like, "Yeah, and that guy never put a dollar in the basket." Bud brought me a half a cup of coffee. And now my mother probably loved me more than anybody else on the planet. I don't think she would have thought that much. But Bud knew the condition I was in. It was raining outside. I had been out in the rain. I was soaking wet. I walked into this freezing cold AA clubhouse and I was shivering. And he knew if he brought me a whole cup of coffee, I'd have spilled it all over myself. So he knew my condition well enough to bring me a half a cup of coffee. Now, that may not sound like much to you, but to me, that is the best example of how one alcoholic can help another based on his own experience, because he knows that. You know, that whole thing in Working with Others where it talks about find out as much as you can about the man so you can put yourself in his shoes to find out how you'd like to be approached. That just blows my mind. And every time I get the opportunity to do this in Alcoholics Anonymous, I make it a point to tell that story. Because it just, to me, says it all. It wasn't, you know, I wish I could tell you it was like a drop-dead meeting. Lights came on for me and I had this spiritual awakening on the spot. Not my experience. That was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. Went to the treatment center. I stayed there about 15 months. In perfect AA fashion. About 3 months prior to leaving, I acquired a girlfriend. She was the counter chick up at the Sunoco station at the corner of Ron Street, right up the street from the bridge. We had many romantic evenings behind the dumpster. And I want to say this is kind of humiliating, but it's my experience, and I think that needs to be told. I was in that treatment center for 15 months. I became the, I don't know, do we have any other rehab presidents or managers, recovery house managers, anything like that? Every time I get sober, I'm the head of the community. I'm the, president of the detox. And I'll be telling people like it's a good thing. So I'm there 15 months. I'm like a feedback cannon. If anybody ever gets in trouble, I'm the guy that chews them out. I do all the house checks. A little bit of power. I didn't want to leave. And, I try to share that often because I find that a lot of us find ourselves in that position, sober. Where I'm from, there's a lot of recovery houses. And there's a lot of people that have been in the recovery house system for years and years and years and years. And, it's almost like you can't even imagine being out of it. And, that particular day, I remember realizing it was like 2 weeks before my 18th birthday, and it was like hitting me, like, oh my God, I'm going to be out of here, man. And I kept getting this thought about what my life used to be like and all people and dealing with people and what am I going to do? Because when I get out of there, I'm no longer the senior member of the community. I'm just some other schlub, and I'm going to be full of fear again. Because I got to tell you, as great as that treatment center was and as much as those people did for me, and they did a lot, that thing that was gnawing at my soul still had me. All the relapse prevention plans in the world were not touching that. The group processes and the things that I talked about, half of which, I got to say this, half of which wasn't even true. I mean, I'm so sick. I'm sitting in group. If somebody says something really traumatic that happened to them, almost to like make them feel better, I'd be like, yeah, man, it happened to me too. And I know that there's some other people in here that do that. It's just one of them things that like nobody ever really talks about. I know that happens. But that thing still had me. It just still had me. I was not treated at that point in my life. Now, mind you, I didn't have a drink for 14 months. So on my 18th birthday, I have this graduation for me. My family comes to see me. My mother and father drove 2 hours to see me. And my father told me about 6 years later, and he's a very deeply religious man, he said, I was driving up the Atlantic City Expressway, and in my mind I was thinking about the story of the prodigal son out of the Bible, where the father gets to bring his son home after his son, riotous living and hookers and wine and all that stuff. And he's like, I just related your life to that story. And let me tell you what I did that day with 14 months sober, knowing what my family was coming to do. I got on a chair in front of the community, played a Bob Dylan song. I cried a little bit, gave a little speech, signed my name on the back of the chair, hugged everybody, and was walking out into the parking lot of that treatment center. And I turned to my mom and dad and said, you guys go ahead. I'm going to go with Jen, who was the girl from the Sunoco. And I remember out of the corner of my eye, I was getting in Jen's car, I caught that look again that I was talking about earlier from my dad. Absolutely sober, I did that. So I was 15 months sober. Could not see the damage that I was causing to my family. And if you would have asked me that day, I probably would have banged on the table talking about I'm doing good because I ain't drank in 14 months. And I know it's controversial, but I'm going to say it anyway just because I'm kind of feeling that way tonight. But my way of always gauging how I'm doing, if you ever want to ask yourself if you're doing good, ask your family. Sometimes I think we in Alcoholics Anonymous do a tremendous disservice to people. And I don't want to minimize the beauty and the miracle of a guy like me not getting loaded for a day, but I can't lose sight of the prize of what's available to in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the truth of the matter is, this illness that I suffer from is not something that I'm going to be able to beat on my own. Like, I can go periods of time without drinking, but I always picked up again. I always drank again because the pain would get too great. So I did that to my father sober. Got really blessed. I spent 4 years in Alcoholics Anonymous after that experience. My life got really good externally. I started a business. I was a little hippie kid. I started selling tie-dye t-shirts. Life got really good. I went to 3, sometimes 4 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a day. I was active in a clubhouse. Clubhouses were great to me, you know, like always something going on there. Business meetings were wonderful. I found I had veins in my forehead and I didn't even know existed. And I really enjoyed just the drama of the club. Because there's all, you know, it's like Sue's sleeping with Joe, Joe's sleeping with Jane, Jane's sleeping with Sue. It's like you can't even keep up with all of it. And guess what? I could go there every day and forget about how my life was slowly beginning to spiral out of control. I refer to it as the Jerry Springer principle. I think that's one of the main reasons why that show is so popular, because you can watch that and feel a lot better about yourself. And I know it's funny, but the truth is, why don't we all stop and ask ourselves the question, do I do that in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes? Because I did that for years. I would sit in meetings and listen to people share and think, thank God I'm not that guy. Never crossed my mind. Maybe I should go up and talk to him, say hello, can I help you out? That never crossed my mind. I would go to business meetings and just raise completely ludicrous motions that would create the most controversy and then watch the show. It's like, I don't even care what the vote was. I just wanted to see an argument. And go figure, after 4 years of that, I couldn't stand it another minute. And I want to say this again, a little controversial. I was crazier after 4 years sober than I was when I got here. A little challenge, just a little challenge. Open your eyes and start watching people around you. And you will watch people get worse, sober. And they're not sneaking off, because I can guarantee you for 4 years there was no late Saturday nights where I was sneaking off by myself. There was none of that. I was getting worse sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting right in the middle of you guys. And I was getting worse. And to be quite honest with you, I started to hate you. Sitting in meetings, listening to people talk. And where I'm from, it's a small little area. So it's just, you know, even though you go to different meetings, it's the same people. And they tend to say the same stuff over and over. And then you start thinking they're mocking you because they know you're aggravated. Although one good thing, because it got me closer to God, because I started to pray as a result of this. My prayers never really progressed past, please God, don't let Bill talk tonight. But at least it was something. I lived on 18th and St. Charles, right on the beach in Ocean City. I could flick a cigarette butt into the ocean from my back deck. I could watch the sun. It was like an old Milwaukee commercial. It don't get no better than that. It really, like in my mind, if you would have asked me when I was a kid in that jail, like, what did you want from your life? I had it. A little tie-dye kid. I had a bunch of little hippie chicks running around, listening to what I said. I was selling tie-dye t-shirts all over the place, making a ton of money. I got to file the Grateful Dead around. That's what I was looking for. And that's what I got. And I was dying. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sit still. I would go to a meeting and then want to be at a different meeting. Then I would leave the meeting and go to the club. And then I would go to the club and think, hey, let's go to the coffee shop. And then I'd get to the coffee shop and wonder who's back at the club. If I was in my house upstairs, I'd want to be downstairs. If I was on my deck, I'd want to be... Like, I just could not get it together. The conversations I was having with myself were progressively getting worse. And you know, we all have those conversations with ourselves. Things were getting hairy. Alcoholics Anonymous almost became an afterthought for me because I got so many different things that I would do to kind of, like, I set myself up from the beginning. I never really wanted anybody's help. I would sit in AA and listen to what you had to say so I could start keeping a file on you. So that when the day would come, because the day would always come when the guy would be put in my path to help me, I needed a reason why I wasn't going to do what you said. So I would listen. All right, guy cheats on his taxes. I'll have to remember that. Guy's cheating on his wife. I'll have to remember that. This guy's 8 years sober on welfare. I'm going to have to remember that. Because the time will come when you would have some insight for me or some direction for me or a suggestion for me. So I needed to have a reason why I wasn't going to take it. Like, that's kind of where I was operating from. No wonder I was totally insane after 4 years sober. Within 4 months, everything in my life was gone. If you would have asked me at that time in my life, my recovery was based on my outside world. The money I had, the girlfriend, the other girlfriend, the car, all that stuff was what I based my recovery on. And one by one, they left. I was left with nothing. I heard a guy speak, and one of these things I always try to share about anytime I get asked to do this in Alcoholics Anonymous, because for my money, and you know, we always sit around waiting for that wisdom, waiting for that pearl. This, for my money, was the best pearl I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a guy that I would least expect it to hear from. Down at Barnegat 5 years ago, at an Acts of Recovery, and this guy was talking about how, you know what's funny? Everybody's running around, and this is a paraphrase because I'm not really good at quoting people. Everybody's running around AA looking for the guy in his first 30 days. We should be looking for the guy in his last 30 days. And here's the crazy part about that experience. When you're that guy that's in his last 30 days, you have no idea. Because I really didn't have a clue what was coming. I was spiraling out of control, but I didn't know. So within 4 months, all that stuff was gone. I played the tape. I knew exactly what was going to happen to me when I drank, and I drank anyway. And within 6 months to the day, I ended up in an abandoned house at Ruth and Clearfield Streets. I'm going to mention it in passing. I developed an addiction to another substance and ended up living on the streets of Philly for about 9 years. In that 9 years, and you know what's funny to me? When I first got sober, I would spend like 56 minutes of my talk talking about them 9 years. And those 9 years for me today mean nothing. My bottom happened that day when I woke up at Ruth and Clearfield. The problem was nobody told me. I just stayed there. I did everything in this world I never thought I would do, and I became everything in this world I never thought I would become. The end for me was I was a homeless panhandler on Roosevelt Boulevard. And the craziest part of that is that while I was doing it, I really didn't even see that there was anything wrong with it. Our book talks about, in the doctor's opinion, the abnormal becomes normal. Didn't even hit me. You know what I mean? Like, I look back on that stuff today, like, I can't even, it's like another life. It's so crazy to me. April 23rd of 2004, I was sitting on a park bench lamenting about what I was going to do about this Russian guy who gets up 10 minutes earlier than me and beats me to the corner that I panhandle on and sells flowers there. The funny thing is, that's funny. But the other side of it is, that's how small my world got. That's how small it was. Now, in my delusional alcohol of mind, I didn't think it would. Like, I thought, in my mind, this was like a big deal, man. This was like a corporate struggle. You know what I mean? Like, court battle, CVS and Rite Aid going to court. Truth is, there's a homeless guy and an immigrant fighting over a corner that's not even theirs. And my best course of action was to stand at the corner and wait for the light to change. I run across and kick his bucket over and then run back the street. It's the best thing I can come up with. But my musing was interrupted by a park ranger. I mean, I'd love to tell you that, you know, it was a blaze of glory, the cops, I had a shootout, and I got locked up by a park ranger. He asked me my name, I gave him a fake name, the whole bit. He figured out all my aliases, up to and including Pete Moss, which is one I tried to use that in the woods one time. And he said, put your hands behind your back. Now, I had no idea, but I'm here to report to you guys that that was God in my life. And I had no idea, man. Believe me, that was not my first time going to jail. And to be quite honest with you, I didn't think it was going to be my last. I would get out of jail wondering when I was coming back and didn't think there was anything wrong with that either. This may be a little strange to say. I actually felt freer in jail sometimes than I ever did on the street. How crazy is that to say? I would get released. Be standing around going, see, I wonder who's got my job in the laundry room. Like, who does that? Like, all I spent was 9 months worrying about how am I going to get out of here. And then you get out and you're thinking, hey, I wonder what so-and-so's doing. Saturday afternoon, they're probably watching that Spanish dancing show that everybody watches. Caliente, I think it's called. How crazy is that? I mean, we're all laughing about it tonight, but that's pretty nuts. I'd be sitting around talking with people about where there are nice, you know, oh, that's a good jail. Does that not freak anybody else out? It makes no sense. But that's where my head was. So I ended up in this cell. Not in the cell. You know, I remember looking across the way and there's like all these people over there. And I'm like waving. I got my own cell. Again, delusional. I'm like, I got my own cell because I'm the man. I know all the guards in here. This is, you know, I run this place. The truth is, they put me in that cell because if they put me in anybody else, they would have kicked the crap out of me because I was a mess. It had been months since I had been in a bath. My hygiene game was not too tight at the time. So I'm in this cell, and I hear this voice. It was almost like somebody was in the cell with me. And the voice said, David, fight's over. Now, I didn't know what that was then. I mean, I went right back to being nuts a second later. But what I can tell you guys tonight, and I can report with confidence, that from that day, and that was a little less than 8 years ago, till this one, I haven't even remotely considered going back to living the way I used to live. And I can't take any credit for that. I did nothing to deserve that. I spent about 2 months in jail, and I can't see what time it is. Does anybody know what time it is? All right. I ended up in a Spanish recovery house in the middle of Germantown. And if anybody knows anything about Philadelphia, that in itself is funny. Aside from the fact that I'm not Spanish. And I walked into this meeting on a Wednesday night in Port Richmond. It's in the book. And Alcoholics Anonymous came to life for me. It was a big book meeting. It was a bunch of men sitting around the table reading out of a book. But these guys talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not going to be so presumptuous as to say people weren't talking about it, but I can assure you I didn't hear it. There's reasons why I didn't hear it, because I was too busy talking to the chick in the back, or I was too busy trying to bum money off somebody, or like I had other motives for being at the meeting. But for whatever reason, I heard the message that night. And those guys talked about Alcoholics Anonymous and two basic principles. Dependence on God and service to other people. And they were talking about going to AA to see what you can bring to it rather than what you can get from it. And I could see in the way they carried themselves, in the way they walked, in the way they talked, that they were getting results. They weren't miserable. They weren't frowning. They weren't complaining about their wives. They were happy. The following week, I asked a guy to be my sponsor. He walked me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in a really quick fashion. And I got this thing, I like to call it spiritual momentum. I don't believe there's time limits or timelines on taking the 12 steps. I don't want to get into that controversy about take them quick, take them slow, do them intellectually. What I can tell you is that this guy opened the book with me, we did what was on the page, and then we went to the next page, we did what was on that page, and so on and so forth, and so on and so forth. When it told us to pray, we prayed. When it told us to write, we wrote. And something started happening to me. I started to catch fire with this thing. It started to become something to me. It started to mean something to me. I suddenly found myself actually paying attention in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I wasn't very astute at for a long time. What I've come to realize is that if recovery doesn't mean anything to you, it doesn't mean anything to you. It's that simple. You can come to a million meetings. But if you're here, but you're not here mentally, and you're not paying attention, it's not going to mean anything. You just continue like that, on and on and on. I did not like that man. That man told me some things in early on when he was sort of walking me through the 12 steps that were very, in my judgment, were very hurtful and mean. I remember after like a month or two of being sober, I was getting a little puffed up a little bit, worked a couple days, had a few bucks in my pocket, was climbing the social ladder in the recovery house. Became chore monitor, which, you know, at the time, it was like a big deal to me. And I remember getting in this car that night, and I'm all, hey, Chris, made chore monitor at the recovery house. And after he was done laughing, he said, Dave, how old are you? I said, I'm 30. He said, well, just don't forget that you're a 30-year-old man with a curfew. Now, that may sound hurtful, and to be honest with you, I thought it was hurtful at the time. But later that night, after we were in the car coming back from the meeting, he was able to explain what he meant by that. That, like, I cannot lose sight of what it is I was brought here to do. I can't lose sight of the fact that, like, there was a feeling in my heart that God cut out of me. There was a destructive force in my life that God took away from me. He didn't take that away from me so that I could just kind of hang out and, you know, worry about whether Harry dusted the radiator in the bathroom of the recovery house. And he was like, look, I think it's cool that you're you build on that stuff. That's all stuff that you build upon to, like, continue moving forward in your life. And he kind of helped me to see that. Just sometimes I felt like, can't you be a little more loving with some of this stuff, dude? Why you always got to kind of come off sideways to me? And what I kind of realized looking back on it, is this probably the only thing I would have heard? Like, after having the experience that I had with the 12 steps and kind of moving forward in Alcoholics Anonymous and my life kind of filling up and becoming full, I look back and realize that God sent that guy to me because he was the only guy I would have heard. Because that guy's so confident in what he's saying. I almost bought into his confidence about what he was saying before I bought into anything else. That's why that guy was put right in front of me that day. I want to share this. I think that Alcoholics Anonymous has kind of morphed for me into like a bunch of different stuff. I spent my first probably 4 or 5 years running around Alcoholics Anonymous like a complete lunatic. I mean, no sleep. We'd be, you know, it was like nothing to just get up, hey, let's go to Virginia tonight. What's that 7 o'clock meeting? Like it was nothing. Be sitting in a diner like it was nothing, 3 o'clock in the morning. Countless fifth steps in my basement. We had a house. It was like 4 or 5 of us in Alcoholics Anonymous all living there. Such a cool experience, and I'm not belittling that. But like as you go on, you realize, like I started to use the fellowship the same way that I used everything else in my life because it does. It feels good. And it was feeling good, man. I was watching the lights come on for people. It was such a great thing. But I really got to be cautious about anything in my life that does that to me. Because without me even realizing it, I started to use that the same way I used everything else in my life. And before I knew it, I'm walking around Alcoholics Anonymous, half dead again. And now, mind you, it's bad enough when you feel half dead in Alcoholics Anonymous. Try feeling half dead at Alcoholics Anonymous when you're sponsoring 40 people. That's not a nice place to be. And you start getting this really crazy thing going in your head. Because people are kind of making you're the greatest thing to save my life. You know, meanwhile, my whole life's falling apart. And I can't understand what's going on. thank God there's other people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are always, you know, that have the same experiences. And I've realized over the last couple of years in my life that a lot of my rigidity about this thing and a lot of my do it this way or die mentality that I walked around with for so long is rooted in my own ego. I have such an undying, God, it almost kills me sometimes, to be right. I just want to be right. And often I am, to be quite honest. But that being said, the price that I have to pay for being right, I pray to God I get more and more willing not to pay that price. Because it ain't a good place to be, man. I don't think when Bill and Bob founded Alcoholics Anonymous, they made it so that a guy like me could come to AA and leave an AA meeting more angrier than I was when I got here. And that was happening to me not too long ago. Because I'd be thinking, I know what everybody should be doing. You know, and I would engage, you know, these conversations. Well, you know what that guy's problem is? You know, we've all done it. How hurtful that can be. And not only, you know, somebody used to talk about, like, yeah, man, it's really hurtful to them. Forget, it's hurtful to me when I live my life that way. I become very sick very quickly. And it's all rooted in this unbelievable desire I have to be right. And I never realized that I'm the kind of guy I can't be right and happy at the same time. Because when I get right, there's a certain edge that I get to being right. Because I'm right. I can't just be, you know, I'm right. It, like, it just always, like, my ego's got to be involved in it. And I heard a guy say this, and then I'll shut up. He told this story, and it kind of conveys, like, my experience at Alcoholics Anonymous better than anything I ever heard. He said, you know, everybody picks a donkey to ride up this hill. Some people take the back to basics donkey. Some people take the just don't drink donkey. Some people take the go to AA and see a psychiatrist donkey. Some people take the 12 steps out of the big book donkey. Point is, everybody's taking a donkey up the hill. How crazy is it of us as alcoholics that once we get up the hill, and the whole point of Alcoholics Anonymous is to get up onto the top of the hill so you can see the view. We all get up the hill, we get there, and then instead of enjoying the view that we're granted by God, we turn around and argue with the next guy about how we got there. It's mind-blowing. There's a freedom that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. Actually, let me not even say that. There's a freedom that you guys gave me from my willingness to just sit down and hear somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys gave that to me. We call it sharing. I think sometimes that word implies that there's some times when you're talking and there's other times when you're listening. And I've realized more recently in my life that I've learned more about people in the last several months from listening to them than I did the last 5 years trying to run everybody else's life and be the director. And I pray to God that I listen more and talk less. I want to really thank you guys for having me. It's a privilege and an honor. I want to thank my wife for driving up with me. Little side note, I got to drive here tonight. If anybody that doesn't know me, I didn't have a license for like 18 years. And I'm finally about 2 weeks away from getting it back. Although I do, I feel like I'm 16 because I have to always get somebody with a license to drive with me. It's always calling me. Just a cool deal, man. I really want to thank you guys for having me, and thanks for listening to me.